The Castle by Franz Kafka, continued. Disc 4.
Teacher, as far as the favour goes, he said, I believe you are mistaken. The favour may be more on my side.
No, said the teacher, smiling, now that he had actually forced Kay to speak. I have precise information about this. Our need for a janitor is about as urgent as our need for a surveyor. Janitor and surveyor, that's a weight round our necks. I must think long and hard about how to justify this expense to the council. But the best and most honest course would simply be to throw the demand down on the table without any attempt to justify it. That's just what I mean, said Kay. Even against your will, you must take me on, no matter how serious the concerns this raises for you. You must still take me on. And when someone is obliged to take a person on and that person lets himself be taken on, then he's the one doing the favour.
Odd, said the teacher. What could possibly compel us to take you on? It's the chairman's kind heart, his excessively kind heart, that compels us to do so.
Surveyor, I see clearly now that you will have to give up many fantasies before you can become a decent janitor. And as for the eventual award of a salary, such comments naturally don't help to create the right atmosphere for that. And I see, too, that your conduct will unfortunately cause me a lot of other trouble as well. You have all this time been negotiating with me, I keep staring and can hardly believe it, in your shirt and underpants.
Yes, Kay exclaimed, laughing and clapping his hands. But those dreadful assistants, what's keeping them?
Frida hurried to the door. The teacher, who noticed that Kay was no longer paying any attention to him, asked Frida when they would move into the schoolhouse.
Today, said Frida.
Well then, tomorrow morning I shall come to check, said the teacher, waving goodbye. He was about to pass through the door, which Frida had opened for herself, when he collided with the maids, who were already carrying in their things so that they could settle back into their room. Blocked by the maids, who would never step aside for anyone, he had to slip between them, followed by Frida.
You're certainly in a hurry, said Kay, very pleased with them now. You come barging in even though we're still here?
They didn't answer. In their embarrassment, they merely twisted the bundles with the all-too-familiar dirty rags sticking out.
"You've probably never washed your things," Kay said, not so much out of malice as with a certain affection. They noticed it, opened their severe mouths, showed their beautiful, strong, animal-like teeth, and laughed silently.
"Well, do come in," said Kay. "Settle down. It is, after all, your own room." Yet since they hesitated, the changes in the room must have taken them aback. Kay took one of them by the arm to lead her in. But he immediately let her go, so startled was the identical stare that, after a brief exchange of glances, they fixed on Kay.
"But you've been staring at me long enough," said Kay, and, fending off a certain unpleasant sensation, he picked up his clothes and shoes, which Frida, with the assistants following timidly behind, had just brought in, and dressed. He had always found Frida's patience with the assistants incomprehensible, and this was once again so. After a long search, she had discovered that the two of them, who ought to have been brushing the clothes in the courtyard, were quietly eating lunch downstairs. The still unbrushed clothes lay crumpled on their laps. Then she was obliged to brush them herself, but though she certainly knew how to keep common people in check, she did nothing to rebuke the assistants, treated their utterly negligent behaviour as a little joke, and even tapped one of them lightly and as if affectionately upon the cheek. Kay wanted to rebuke her later for this, but now it was high time to leave.
"The assistants will stay behind to help you move," said Kay. Yet they weren't willing to accept this. Well-fed and cheerful as they were now, they would have liked a little exercise. Only when Frida said, "You are staying here," did they fall in line.
"Do you know where I'm going?" asked Kay.
"Yes," said Frida.
"So you're no longer keeping me here?" asked Kay.
"You'll run into so many obstacles," she said, "and then what would my words mean?"
She kissed Kay goodbye, and, since he hadn't eaten at noon, gave him a small package with bread and sausage, which she had brought up from the kitchen, reminded him that he should not come here but rather straight to the school, and accompanied him, with her hand on his shoulder, to the door.
Chapter 8. Waiting for Clam.
At first, Kay was glad to have escaped the crush of maids and assistants in that warm room. Besides, it was almost freezing, the snow was firmer, the walking easier. Only it was getting darker, and he hastened his step. The castle, whose contours were already beginning to dissolve, lay still as ever. Kay had never seen the slightest sign of life up there. Perhaps it wasn't even possible to distinguish anything from this distance, and yet his eyes demanded it and refused to tolerate the stillness. When Kay looked at the castle, it was at times as if he were watching someone who sat there calmly, gazing into space, not lost in thought and therefore cut off from everything, but free and untroubled, as if he were alone, unobserved. And yet it could not have escaped him that someone was observing him, but this didn't disturb his composure, and indeed, one could not tell whether through cause or effect, the observer's gaze could not remain fixed there and slid off. Today this impression was further reinforced by the early darkness. The longer he looked, the less he could make out, and the deeper everything sank into the twilight. Just as Kay reached the gentleman's inn, which was still dark, a window opened on the second floor, and a fat, clean-shaven young gentleman in a fur coat leaned out, then stood by the window, and didn't seem to respond with even the slightest nod to Kay's greeting. Kay did not encounter anybody in the corridor or the taproom. The smell of stale beer in the taproom was even worse than of late. This sort of thing surely never happened at the inn by the bridge. Kay immediately went to the door through which he had recently observed Clam, pressed the handle cautiously, but the door was locked. He felt about for the peephole, but the catch was no doubt so evenly inset that he couldn't find the spot, so he lit a match. At that he was startled by a shout. In the corner between the door and the sideboard near the stove cowered a young girl in the light of the flaring match and stared at him with laboriously opened, sleep-filled eyes. This was obviously Frida's successor. Quickly she recovered her composure, turned on the electric light, an angry expression still on her face, then recognized Kay. "Oh, the surveyor," she said, smiling, as she held out her hand to him and introduced herself. "My name is Peppy." She was small, rosy, and healthy. Her plentiful reddish-blonde hair was plaited in a thick braid, and it curled about her face. She wore a dress of shiny grey material that scarcely suited her, hung straight down, and was gathered below in a clumsy, childlike manner by a silk band ending in a bow, so that it restricted her movements. She asked about Frida, whether she would be back soon. The question almost verged on malice. "I was summoned at once," she then said, "urgently, when Frida left, because after all they can't use just any old person in this position. I was a chambermaid until then, but this hasn't been a good exchange for me. There's a great deal of evening and night work here. It's very tiring. I shall probably find it unbearable. It doesn't surprise me that Frida gave it up." "Frida was always very satisfied here," said Kay, in order to finally alert Peppy to the difference that existed between Frida and herself and that she failed to take into account. "Don't believe her," said Peppy. "Frida can control herself in a way almost nobody else can. If she doesn't want to confess something, she simply doesn't confess it, so nobody even knows she has something to confess. But I have been in service with her here for several years. We have always slept together in the same bed, but I'm not all that close to her, and she certainly never even thinks of me now. Her only friend, perhaps, is the old landlady from the Bridge Inn, but that, too, is indicative." "Frida is my fiancée," said Kay, as he attempted to find the peephole in the door. "I know," said Peppy. "That's why I'm telling you this. Otherwise it would be of no importance to you." "I understand," said Kay. "You mean I can be proud of having won myself such a reserved girl?" "Yes," she said, laughing happily, as though she had gained Kay's complicity in a furtive agreement concerning Frida. Yet it was not actually the words that bothered Kay and distracted him slightly from his search, but rather her appearance and her presence in this place. Of course, she was indeed considerably younger than Frida, almost childlike, and her clothes were ridiculous, for she had obviously dressed in a manner that reflected her exaggerated notions of a barmaid's importance. And in a way these notions of hers were even justified, for she had probably been granted the position, for which she was still altogether unsuited, unexpectedly, without merit, and only temporarily, for she hadn't even been entrusted with the small leather bag that Frida always wore on her belt. And as for her supposed dissatisfaction with the position, that was nothing but arrogance. And yet, despite her childish lack of common sense, even she probably had connections with the castle. She had, unless she was lying, been a chambermaid. Without any knowledge of what she possessed, she dozed away her days here, and though one couldn't snatch the possession from her by embracing this small, fat, slightly round-backed body, one could touch it and cheer oneself up for the difficult path ahead. So this was perhaps no different than with Frida. Oh yes, it was different. One only had to think of the look on Frida's face to understand this. Kay would never have touched Peppy. Still, for a moment he had to cover his eyes, so lecherously was he staring at her. "There's no need for the light," said Peppy, switching it off again. "I only turned it on because you gave me such a fright. What are you doing here? Has Frida forgotten something?"
"Yes," said Kay, pointing to the door. "Right next door, a tablecloth, a crocheted white tablecloth."
"Oh, yes, her tablecloth," said Peppy. "I remember, a beautiful piece. I even helped her with it, but it's hardly in that room."
"Well, Frida thinks so. Anyhow, who lives there?" asked Kay.
"Nobody," said Peppy. "It's the gentleman's room. That's where the gentlemen eat and drink. Or rather, it is meant for their use, but most gentlemen stay upstairs in their rooms."
"If I knew," said Kay, "that there was nobody next door, I'd gladly go in to look for the tablecloth. But one cannot be certain of that. Clam, for instance, likes to sit there."
"Clam is certainly not there now," said Peppy. "Indeed, he's about to leave. The sleigh is already waiting in the courtyard."
Immediately, without a word of explanation, Kay left the taproom and once in the corridor turned, not toward the exit, but toward the interior of the house, and in just a few steps reached the courtyard. How still and beautiful it was here! A four-sided courtyard closed off on three sides by the building and toward the street, a side street unfamiliar to Kay, by a high white wall with a large, heavy, and now open gate. Here, on the side facing the courtyard, the building seemed taller than in front, or at least the second floor had been fully finished and seemed bigger, for it was surrounded by a wooden gallery, entirely closed except for a narrow opening at eye level. Diagonally opposite Kay, still in the central section but right in the corner where it joined the side wing opposite, was an open entrance to the house with no door. Before it stood a dark, closed sleigh to which two horses were harnessed. Except for the coachman, whose presence at this distance in the twilight Kay suspected rather than perceived, there wasn't a soul in sight. Hands in his pockets, looking about carefully, Kay went around two sides of the courtyard, staying close to the wall until he reached the sleigh. Sunk in his fur coat, the coachman, one of the peasants who had been in the taproom the other evening, had watched Kay approach, impassively, as one follows the progress of a cat. Even when Kay came and stood next to him, greeting him, and the horses grew somewhat restless because of the man appearing out of the dark, he remained entirely unconcerned. This was agreeable to Kay. Leaning against the wall, he unpacked his food, thought gratefully of Frida, who had been so solicitous, and peered into the interior of the house. A stairway turning at a right angle led downward and was crossed at the bottom by a low but seemingly deep passageway. Everything was clean, whitewashed, set off sharply and evenly. The wait took longer than Kay had expected. He had long since finished the food. It was bitterly cold. The twilight had already yielded to complete darkness, and yet there was still no sign of Clam. "It can take a lot longer," said a coarse voice all of a sudden, so close to Kay that he started. It was the coachman, who, as if awakening, stretched and yawned loudly. "What can take a lot longer?" asked Kay, pleased by the interruption, for the constant stillness and tension had grown irksome. "Till you leave," said the coachman. Kay did not understand him, but asked no more questions. He believed this was the best way to get this arrogant person to speak. Not answering here in the dark was already incitement enough. And indeed, a moment later the coachman had asked, "Would you like some cognac?" "Yes," said Kay, without thinking, all too tempted by the offer, for he was shivering. "Then open the sleigh," said the coachman. "There are a few bottles in the side pocket. Take one, have a drink, and then hand it to me. It's too awkward getting down with this fur coat on." Kay was annoyed at having to lend a hand, but seeing as he was already mixed up with the coachman, he obeyed, even at the risk of having someone like Clam, say, catch him in the sleigh. He opened the wide door and could easily have pulled the bottle out of the bag fixed to the inner door, but now that the door was open he had such an urge to enter the sleigh that he could not resist. He would only sit there a moment. He slipped in. How extraordinarily warm it was in the sleigh, and it didn't cool off, even though the door, which Kay did not dare close, was wide open. And there wasn't even any way of knowing if one was sitting on a bench. There were so many blankets, cushions, and furs. On each side one could turn and stretch in every direction, and always sink down soft and warm. With his arms extended, his head supported by the abundant supply of cushions, Kay gazed from the sleigh into the dark house. Why was it taking Clam so long to come down? As if dazed by the warmth after having stood so long in the snow, Kay wished that Clam would finally come. The thought that he would rather not be seen by Clam occurred to him only vaguely as a slight distraction.
His forgetfulness was reinforced by the conduct of the coachman, who must have known that he was in the sleigh, but left him here without even asking for the cognac. That was considerate, but of course Kay wanted to do him a service. Cumbersomely, without changing position, he reached over to the side pocket, not to the one on the open door, that was too far, but to the one on the closed door behind him. But it didn't matter. There were bottles here, too. He took one out, unscrewed the cap, smelled it, and then had to smile involuntarily. The smell was so sweet, so pleasant, so much like praise and kind words from someone you're very fond of, though you don't quite know what it is all about and do not want to know either, and are simply happy in the knowledge that it is he who is saying such things. "And this is supposed to be cognac?" Kay asked dubiously, trying it out of curiosity. But it was indeed cognac, oddly enough, warm and burning. How it changed as one drank from something that was virtually no more than a bearer of sweet fragrance into a drink fit for a coachman. "Can it be?" Kay asked, as though reproaching himself, and drank again. At that, just as Kay was engaged in taking a long sip, it became bright. The electric light came on, not only inside, on the stairs, in the passage and in the corridor, but outside, above the entrance. Footsteps could be heard descending the stairs. The bottle fell from Kay's hand. Cognac spilled onto a fur. Kay jumped from the sleigh. He had no sooner slammed the door with a thud than a gentleman came slowly out of the house. The only consolation, it seemed, was that it wasn't Clam. Or was that actually cause for regret? It was the gentleman whom Kay had already seen at the second-floor window. A young gentleman, extremely good-looking, pale and reddish, but quite grave. Kay gave him a gloomy look as well, but it was really aimed at himself. It would, after all, have been better to have sent the assistants here, for even they would have been capable of conducting themselves as he had done. The gentleman opposite still hadn't spoken, as if there weren't enough breath in his extremely broad chest for the words about to be spoken. "This is really terrible," he then said, pushing his hat off his forehead a little. "What?" Though the gentleman didn't know about Kay's having been in the sleigh, he already thought something was terrible? That Kay had, say, penetrated into the courtyard? "Now, how did you get here?" the gentleman asked, more softly, already exhaling, reconciled to the inevitable. What questions? What answers? Perhaps he should assure the gentleman that the path on which he had set out with such hope had led nowhere. Instead of answering him, Kay turned to the sleigh, opened the door, and retrieved his cap, which he had left inside. With discomfort, he noticed that the cognac was dripping onto the footboard. Then he turned toward the gentleman again. He was no longer hesitant to reveal that he had been in the sleigh. That wasn't the worst part. If he were asked, but only then, he would certainly not refrain from saying that the coachman himself had given the order, at least the one to open the sleigh. Actually, the worst part was that the gentleman had surprised him and that there hadn't been enough time to hide from him and to wait undisturbed for Clam, or rather, that he hadn't shown sufficient presence of mind to stay in the sleigh, close the door, and wait there on the fur blankets for Clam, or at the very least to stay there while the gentleman was still around. True, he couldn't have known whether Clam himself might not come now, in which case it would naturally have been better not to greet him outside. Yes, several things ought to have been taken into consideration here, but not now, for it was all over. "Come with me," said the gentleman, not quite as an order, and yet it was an order, not so much in the words as in the accompanying gesture, a short and deliberately indifferent wave. "I'm waiting here for someone," Kay said, no longer in hope of success, but simply as a matter of principle. "Come," the gentleman repeated, not in the least deterred, as if he wanted to show that he had never doubted that Kay was waiting for somebody. "But then I'll miss the person I'm waiting for," said Kay, flinching. Regardless of everything that had happened, he had the feeling that what he had achieved here was a kind of possession, which he only apparently retained, but that needn't be surrendered simply upon some arbitrary command. "You'll miss him whether you wait or go," said the gentleman, whose opinion certainly was dismissive, but also showed remarkable indulgence for Kay's train of thought. "Then I would rather miss him as I wait," said Kay defiantly. "It would take more than mere words from this young gentleman to drive him away." At that, the gentleman, with a superior expression on his tilted face, closed his eyes for a moment, as though he wanted to leave Kay's unreasonableness behind and resume his own reasoning, ran the tip of his tongue over the lips of his barely open mouth, and said to the coachman, "Unharness the horses." The coachman, submissive toward the gentleman, but with an angry side glance at Kay, finally had to climb down in his fur coat, and then, very hesitantly, as though he did not so much expect the gentleman to rescind his order as Kay to change his mind, began to draw the horses and sleigh backwards to the side wing, in which, apparently behind a large gate, the stable with the carriage shed was to be found. Kay saw himself being left alone. On one side the sleigh was retreating, as was also, on the other, along the very path Kay himself had taken, the young gentleman, though both went quite slowly, as though wanting to show Kay that it was still in his power to call them back. Perhaps he had that power, but it would have done him no good. To call the sleigh back would be to drive himself away. So he stood still, the only one who had held his ground. But it was a victory that gave no joy. He looked at the gentleman and then at the coachman. The gentleman had already reached the door through which Kay had first entered the courtyard. He glanced back again. Kay thought he could see him shake his head over such stubbornness. And then, in a resolute, brief, final motion, he turned around and entered the corridor, where he immediately disappeared. The coachman remained in the courtyard. The sleigh gave him a great deal of work to do. He had to open the heavy stable door, drive the sleigh in backwards, unharness the horses, and lead them to their stalls. He did all this gravely, lost in thought, having given up all hope of an excursion. The man's silent bustle, without even a glance in his direction, seemed to Kay a far harsher reproach than the conduct of the gentleman. And now, when after finishing his work in the stable, the coachman walked straight across the courtyard with his slow, swaying gait, closed the large gate, then came back, all this slowly and meticulously focusing only on his own tracks in the snow, then locked the stable behind him and all the electric lights went out, for whom should they have shone, and only the opening above in the wooden gallery remained bright and briefly arrested one's wandering gaze, it seemed to Kay as if they had broken off all contact with him, but as if he were freer than ever and could wait as long as he wanted here in this place where he was generally not allowed, and as if he had fought for this freedom for himself in a manner nobody else could have done, and as if nobody could touch him or drive him away or even speak to him, yet, and this conviction was at least equally strong, as if there were nothing more senseless, nothing more desperate than this freedom, this waiting, this invulnerability.
Chapter 9. The Struggle Against the Interrogation.
And he tore himself away and went back toward the house, this time not along the wall, but straight through the snow. In the corridor he met the landlord, who greeted him silently and pointed to the taproom door. He followed his gesture because he was cold and because he wanted to see people, but was very disappointed when he saw the young gentleman sitting at a little table, which had surely been put there specifically for that purpose, since they usually made do with barrels, and standing in front of him, an oppressive sight for Kay, the landlady from the Bridge Inn.
Peppy, proud, with her head thrown back, always the same smile, unshakably conscious of her dignity, swinging her braid at every turn, hurried to and fro, brought beer and then a pen and ink, for the gentleman had spread papers out in front of him and was comparing figures, which he found now in this paper, now in another at the far end of the table, and was about to start writing. From her full height, the landlady gazed down in silence at the gentleman and his papers, her lips slightly pursed, as though she had said all that was necessary, and it had been well received.
"The surveyor, finally," said the gentleman, glancing up as Kay entered, then burying himself once again in his papers. The landlady, too, only looked at Kay indifferently, not at all surprised. Peppy, though, seemed to notice Kay only when he went up to the counter and ordered a cognac. Kay leaned on it, put his hand over his eyes, and ignored everything else. Then he sipped some of the cognac and pushed it away, saying it was undrinkable.
"All of the gentlemen drink it," Peppy said curtly, poured out the rest, washed the small glass, and put it on the shelf.
"The gentlemen have something better than this," said Kay.
"Possibly," said Peppy, "but I don't."
And at that she had finished with Kay, and was again at the service of the gentleman, who did not require anything, though, and so she merely walked from one side to the other behind him, deferentially attempting to look over his shoulder at the papers. Yet this was nothing but idle curiosity and boastfulness, which even the landlady criticised by knitting her eyebrows. Yet all of a sudden the landlady pricked up her ears and, listening intently, stared into space. Kay turned around. He heard nothing out of the ordinary. The others apparently hadn't heard anything either, but the landlady, with long strides and on tiptoe, ran to the rear door, which led to the courtyard, looked through the keyhole, turned to the others with wide-open eyes and a flushed face, beckoning them with her finger.
And each one looked through. The landlady got the most turns, but Pepe was not left out either, the gentleman being the most indifferent of the three. Pepe and the gentleman soon came back. Now only the landlady was still straining to see, bending over, almost kneeling. You almost had the impression she was pleading with the keyhole to let her through, for there had probably been nothing to see for some time now. Yet when she finally stood up, passed her hands over her face, fixed her hair, took a deep breath, was evidently obliged to readjust her eyes to the room and to the people here, which she reluctantly did, Kay said, not so as to confirm what he already knew, but to ward off an attack that he almost feared, so vulnerable was he now, "So Clam is already gone?" The landlady walked past him in silence, but from his little table the gentleman said, "Yes, certainly. Once you gave up your sentry post, Clam was naturally able to leave. But it's wonderful how sensitive the gentleman is. Landlady, did you notice how uneasily Clam looked about him?" The landlady appeared not to have noticed it, but the gentleman went on, "Well, fortunately, there was no longer anything to be seen. The coachman had smoothed out the footprints in the snow with a broom." "The landlady didn't notice anything," said Kay, not in hope of success, but simply irritated by the gentleman's assertion, which had been made to sound so conclusive and irreversible. "Perhaps I wasn't at the keyhole just then," the landlady said, coming to the gentleman's defence. But then, wanting to give Clam his due, she added, "Still, I don't believe in this great sensitivity of Clam's. We are indeed concerned about him. We try to protect him, on the assumption that Clam is extremely sensitive. That is fine, and certainly the will of Clam. How the situation is in reality, though, we don't know. Certainly Clam will never speak to anyone he doesn't want to speak to, no matter how strenuously a certain individual exerts himself, and no matter how insufferably he pushes himself to the fore. But this fact alone, that Clam will never speak to him, will never allow him to come face to face with him, is already quite enough, for in reality why shouldn't he be capable of enduring the sight of anybody whomsoever? This cannot be proved, for it'll never come to a test." The gentleman nodded eagerly. "I am, of course, of the same opinion," he said. "If I put the matter a little differently just now, it was only so as to make it comprehensible for the surveyor. It's correct, though, that after coming outside, Clam did look around repeatedly in a half-circle." "Perhaps he was looking for me," said Kay. "Possibly," said the gentleman. "That never occurred to me." Everybody laughed, Pepe, who barely understood any of this, the loudest. "Since we're all so cheerfully assembled," said the gentleman, "I would ask, sir, that you give me some information to complete my files." "A lot of writing goes on here," said Kay, looking from a distance at the files. "Yes, a bad habit," said the gentleman, laughing again. "But perhaps you still don't know who I am. I am Momus, Clam's village secretary." After those words were spoken, the entire room became serious. Although the landlady and Pepe clearly knew the gentleman well, they still seemed upset by the reference to his name and title. And even the gentleman himself, as though what he had said exceeded his own comprehension, and as if he wanted to flee all traces of the solemnity his words had subsequently acquired, buried himself in his files and began to write, and then there was not a sound in the room save for his pen. "And so what is that? Village secretary?" Kay asked after a little while. The landlady, speaking on behalf of Momus, who, now that he had introduced himself, considered it inappropriate to offer any further explanation, said, "Mr. Momus is Clam's secretary, just like any of Clam's secretaries, but his office and also, if I'm not mistaken, his jurisdiction—" Momus shook his head vigorously as he wrote, and the landlady corrected herself. "So it's only his official seat, not his official jurisdiction, that is confined to the village. Mr. Momus handles all of Clam's written work in the village, and is first to receive all petitions sent to Clam from the village." Since Kay, still little affected by these matters, was gazing at her blankly, she added in a half-embarrassed voice, "That's the arrangement. All of the gentlemen from the castle have their own village secretaries." Momus, who had followed everything more closely than had Kay, elaborated for the benefit of the landlady. "Most village secretaries work only for a single gentleman, but I work for two. For Clam and for Valabene." "Yes," said the landlady, in turn recalling that this was indeed so, and turning to Kay. "Mr. Momus works for two gentlemen, for Clam and for Valabene, so he is a village secretary twice over." "Twice over, indeed," said Kay, nodding at Momus, who was almost leaning forward and gazing straight up at Kay, just as one nods at a child whom one has just heard being praised in one's presence. If there was a certain contempt in Kay's remark, it either passed unnoticed or was exactly what they wanted.
for they were discussing the merits of a man from Clam's immediate entourage in front of Kay, who wasn't even sufficiently worthy to be seen by Clam, not even by chance, and they did so with the unconcealed intention of provoking Kay's recognition and praise. And yet Kay didn't truly feel so inclined. Striving as he was with all his might to gain a glimpse of Clam, he had little respect for the post of a Momus, who was allowed to live in sight of Clam. Far be it from him to feel admiration or even envy, since it was not the closeness to Clam in itself that was worth striving for, but rather that he, Kay, and he alone, not anybody else with his wishes or anybody else's, should approach Clam, and approach him not so as to rest there with him, but to get past him and go on into the castle. And he looked at his watch and said, "But I must go home now." Immediately the relationship changed in Momus's favour. "Why, of course," said Momus, "your janitorial duties beckon. But you must give me another moment, just a few short questions." "I don't feel like it," said Kay, and he started toward the door. Slamming a file on the table, Momus stood up. "In the name of Clam, I call upon you to answer my questions." "In the name of Clam?" Kay repeated. "Is he concerned about my affairs, then?" "That," said Momus, "is something I have no opinion about, and you surely even less so. So the two of us need have no qualms in leaving the matter to him. Nevertheless, by virtue of the position bestowed upon me by Clam, I call upon you to stay and answer." "Surveyor," the landlady broke in, "I'll be careful not to give you any more advice. My previous suggestions, the most well-meant suggestions conceivable, were turned down in a most disgraceful way, and I came here to the secretary. I have nothing to hide, only so as to notify the administration of your conduct and intentions in an appropriate manner, and to guard against the possibility of your ever being lodged with me again. That's how things stand between the two of us, and this isn't likely to change. And so if I give you my opinion, I do so not to help you, but to ease somewhat the difficult task of the secretary, who has to deal with a person such as you. Still, and it's only by being frank that I can associate with you at all, and then only with great reluctance, you can profit from what I say. You need only have the desire to do so. And just in case you do, I should like to draw your attention to the following. In your case, the only path leading to Clam passes through the secretary's depositions. But I don't wish to exaggerate. Perhaps this path doesn't lead to Clam. Perhaps it ends long before it reaches him. That decision is made by the secretary at his own discretion. Anyhow, for you, this is the only path that does at least lead in Clam's direction. And you want to give up the only path for no reason other than contrariness?" "Oh, landlady," said Kay, "it is not the only path leading to Clam, nor is it of greater value than the others. And it is you, Mr. Secretary, who decides whether or not anything I might say here will reach Clam." "Certainly," said Momus, lowering his eyes with pride and gazing right and left where there was nothing to be seen. "Why else would I be secretary?" "You see, landlady," said Kay, "it's not to Clam that I need a path, but first to the secretary." "That's the path I wanted to open up for you," said the landlady. "Didn't I offer this morning to forward your request to Clam? That would have happened through the secretary. But you rejected the offer, and now you have no alternative. Of course, after your performance today, after your attempt to waylay Clam, you'll have even less prospect of success. But this final, tiniest, vanishing, even non-existent hope is your only hope." "How is it, landlady," said Kay, "that you initially tried so hard to prevent me from pressing on to Clam, and now take my request so seriously, and seem to think I'm lost, as it were, if my plans fail? If it at one point was possible to advise me sincerely from the bottom of one's heart against any attempt to reach Clam, how can one now with seemingly equal sincerity almost push me along the path to Clam, which of course may never lead to him?" "So I'm pushing you, am I?" said the landlady. "Do you mean that I'm pushing you when I call your attempts hopeless? Now that truly would be the height of audacity, if in this way you were trying to shift your own responsibility for yourself onto me. Might it be the presence of the secretary that prompts you to do so? No, surveyor, I'm certainly not pushing you to do anything at all. I have only one thing to confess, that when I first saw you, I may have overestimated you a little. Your quick victory over Frieda frightened me. I didn't know what you might still be capable of. I wanted to ward off additional misfortunes, and thought the only way I could bring this about was by shocking you with pleas and threats. Meanwhile, I have learned to think about everything more calmly. You may do exactly as you like. In the snow outside in the courtyard, your deeds will perhaps leave deep footprints, but that's all." "I don't think the contradiction is entirely resolved," said Kay, "but I'm satisfied now that I have alerted you to it. But, Secretary, I would ask you to tell me whether the landlady's opinion is correct, namely, whether the deposition you want to take from me could lead to my being allowed to appear before Clam. If that is so, then I'm ready to answer all questions right away. In that respect, I am certainly ready for everything.
No, said Momus, there are no such connections.
I'm simply interested in getting a precise description of this afternoon for Clam's village registry. The description is ready. You need only fill in two or three gaps, simply as a matter of form. There is no other objective, and none can be attained. Kay looked in silence at the landlady.
Why are you looking at me? The landlady asked. Isn't that exactly what I told you?
He's always like this, Secretary. He's always like this. Distorts the information given to him, then claims he's been given the wrong information. I have been telling him forever and ever, and once again today, that there isn't the slightest chance of his being received by Clam. Now, if there is no such chance, he won't get it through this deposition either. Could anything be clearer than that? Besides, I've been telling him that this deposition is the only truly official connection that he can have with Clam. But this, too, is altogether clear and indubitable. But if he doesn't believe me, and constantly hopes, I don't know why and to what end, to be able to reach Clam, then his sole hope, if one keeps to his train of thought, lies in the only truly official connection that he has with Clam, namely, in this deposition. That's all I have said, and anyone who says otherwise is twisting my words maliciously.
Landlady, if that is so, said Kay, then please excuse me, for I have indeed misunderstood you. I gathered from your earlier remarks, mistakenly, as it now turns out, that there is the tiniest hope for me.
Certainly, said the landlady, I think so. But now you're twisting my words again, only this time the other way around. I think there is some such hope for you, but it is based solely on this deposition. Yet the situation isn't such that you can simply attack the secretary with the question, will I be allowed to see Clam if I answer the questions? When a child asks in such a way, one laughs. When an adult does so, it's an insult to the office. Only the secretary has graciously concealed this through the delicacy of his reply. But the hope I have in mind has to do with your possessing through the deposition a kind of connection, perhaps a kind of connection with Clam. Isn't that hope enough? If you were asked about the accomplishments that make you worthy of the gift of such hope, could you come up with anything at all? Of course, one cannot speak more precisely about this hope, and in his official capacity, the secretary in particular would not be able to give even the slightest hint of this. For him, it is, as he said, only a matter of getting a description of this afternoon. Simply as a matter of form, he will say no more, even if you were to question him right now about my statements.
So then, secretary, asked Kay, will Clam read this deposition?
No, said Momus. Why should he? After all, Clam cannot read every deposition, and indeed he reads none.
Don't come anywhere near me with those depositions, he often says.
Surveyor, the landlady complained, you exhaust me by asking such questions. For is it truly necessary, let alone desirable, that Clam should read this deposition and get to know the trifling details of your life, word for word? Wouldn't you prefer to request most humbly that the report be hidden from Clam? A request, by the way, that would be just as foolish as your previous one, for who can hide anything from Clam, but one that would nonetheless reveal a more sympathetic character. And is this necessary for what you call your hope? Didn't you yourself state that you'd be satisfied if you could only have an opportunity to speak in the presence of Clam, even if he neither looked at you nor listened to you? And through this deposition, won't you obtain at least that much, and perhaps far more?
Far more? Asked Kay. In what way?
If only you didn't always, like a child, insist on having everything served up right away in edible form, cried the landlady. For who can come up with answers to such questions? The deposition goes into Clam's village registry. This you have already heard, and no more can be said with any certainty. But can you truly grasp the full meaning of the deposition, of the secretary, of the village registry? Do you know what it means to be interrogated by the secretary? This is something that he himself may not, or probably doesn't, know. He sits quietly here doing his duty simply as a matter of form, as he said. But remember that he was appointed by Clam, that he works in Clam's name, that everything he does, even if Clam never hears about it, still has Clam's approval from the outset. And how can anything have Clam's approval that isn't filled with his spirit? Far be it from me to want to flatter the secretary blatantly. He himself would even forbid this. But I'm not talking about his personality as an independent individual, but rather about what he is when he has Clam's approval, as he does now, for instance. Then he is an instrument upon which Clam's hand lies, and woe betide anybody who will not submit to him.
The landlady's threats did not frighten Kay.
The hopes with which she sought to trap him wearied him. Clam was remote. The landlady had once compared Clam to an eagle, and that had seemed ridiculous to Kay, but no longer. He considered Clam's remoteness, his impregnable abode, his muteness, broken perhaps only by shouts the likes of which Kay had never heard before, his piercing, downturned gaze, which could never be proved, never be refuted, and his, from Kay's position below, indestructible circles, which he was describing up there in accordance with incomprehensible laws, visible only for seconds, all this Clam and the eagle had in common. But it certainly had nothing to do with the deposition over which just now Momus broke a salted pretzel, which he enjoyed with his beer, sprinkling all his papers with salt and caraway seeds. "Good night," said Kay. "I have an aversion to all manner of interrogations." And now he actually did go to the door. "So he is indeed leaving," said Momus to the landlady, almost anxiously. "He wouldn't dare," said the landlady. Kay heard no more. He was already in the corridor. It was cold. There was a strong wind blowing. From a door opposite came the landlord. He seemed to have been observing the corridor from behind a peephole. He had to tie his coattails around his body, so strongly did the wind pull at them, even here in the corridor. "Surveyor, you're already leaving?" he said. "That surprises you?" asked Kay. "Yes," said the landlord. "Were you not interrogated, then?" "No," said Kay. "I did not submit to the interrogation." "Why not?" asked the landlord. "It is unclear to me," said Kay, "why I should let myself be interrogated, why I should subject myself to a prank or an official whim. Perhaps I would have done so another time, also as a joke or whim, but not today." "To be sure," said the landlord, but his assent was merely polite, not convinced. "But now I must let the servants into the taproom," he said. "Their allotted time began quite a while ago, only I didn't want to interrupt the interrogation." "So you thought it that important?" asked Kay. "Oh, yes," said the landlord. "So I ought not to have refused?" asked Kay. "No," said the landlord. "You ought not to have done so." Since Kay remained silent, he added, either to console Kay or to hasten his own departure, "There, there, this doesn't mean that sulphur will come raining down right away from the heavens." "No," said Kay, "not by the looks of the weather." And they parted, laughing. Chapter 10. On the Street. Kay stepped out on the wild, blustery steps and gazed into the darkness. Nasty, nasty weather. Somehow, in connection with this, he thought of how the landlady had endeavoured to make him amenable to the deposition, and how he had held his ground. It was not a candid effort, though, for she had at the same time furtively dragged him away from the deposition, and ultimately one couldn't tell whether one had held one's ground or given way. An intriguer by nature, operating like the wind, seemingly to no end, upon remote alien instructions that one never got to see. No sooner had he taken a few steps along the main road than he saw two wavering lights in the distance. This sign of life pleased him, and he hurried toward them, and they in turn glided toward him. He had no idea why he was so greatly disappointed on seeing the assistants. It was indeed they coming toward him, probably sent by Frida, and the lanterns that rescued him from the darkness, in which there were noises all around him, were his all right. But he was disappointed. He had expected strangers, not these old acquaintances who were a burden to him. But it wasn't just the assistants. Out of the dark between them stepped Barnabas. "Barnabas," cried Kay, extending his hand, "you've come to see me?" The surprise at seeing him made Kay initially forget all the trouble Barnabas had caused him. "Yes, to see you," said Barnabas, as cordially as ever, "with a letter from Clam." "A letter from Clam," said Kay, throwing his head back and taking the letter quickly from Barnabas's hand. "Give me some light," he told the assistants, who drew close on either side, raising their lanterns. Kay had to fold the large sheet up tiny in order to shield it from the wind. Then he read, "To the land surveyor at the Bridge Inn. The surveying work that you have carried out so far meets with my approval. The assistants' work is also praiseworthy. You really know how to induce them to work. Do not relax your exertions. Carry your work to a successful conclusion. Any interruption would embitter me, but rest assured, the question of remuneration will soon be resolved. I will keep you in mind." Kay looked up from the letter only when the assistants, who read much more slowly than he, gave three loud hurrahs in celebration of the good news and swung the lanterns. "Be quiet," he said, and then to Barnabas, "It's a misunderstanding." Barnabas did not understand him. "It's a misunderstanding," Kay repeated. and the weariness brought on by the afternoon came over him again. The school was still such a long way off, and behind him seemed to loom up the entire Barnabas family. The assistant still clung to Kay, so he elbowed them aside. Why had Frieda sent them out to meet him when he had expressly ordered that they should stay with her? Besides, he could certainly have found the way home alone, and it would have been easier alone than in such company. And now, to crown it all, one of them had wrapped about his neck a scarf with loose ends flapping in the wind that had already hit Kay several times in the face, and though the other assistant had always lifted the scarf off Kay's face right away with his long, pointed, continually fidgeting fingers, this hadn't improved matters. Both of them even seemed to have enjoyed the to and fro, just as the wind and the unruly night excited them. "Go away!" Kay shouted. "Since you insisted on coming, why didn't you bring my walking stick? And now what can I use to drive you home?" They ducked behind Barnabas, but their fear did not prevent the two of them, one on either side, from placing their lanterns on the shoulders of their defender, but of course he shook them off right away. "Barnabas," said Kay, and it weighed upon his heart that Barnabas obviously couldn't understand him, that though his jacket gave off a brilliant sheen in times that were calm, when the situation became serious, Barnabas was no help at all. He simply resorted to a kind of silent resistance that was impossible to overcome, for he was quite defenceless. All that glittered at such moments was his smile, but it was about as effective as the stars above against the gale down here. "Look what the gentleman wrote," Kay said, holding the letter up to his face. "The gentleman is ill-informed, for I am not doing any work as surveyor, and as for the assistants, you can see what they are worth. And work I am not doing, I obviously cannot interrupt. I cannot even arouse the gentleman's bitterness, so how could I earn his recognition? And I will never be able to rest assured." "I'll deliver the message," said Barnabas, who had been looking past the letter, which in any case he couldn't have read, for he had put it right next to his face. "Oh," said Kay, "you promised to deliver it, but can I really believe you? I need a trustworthy messenger so badly now more than ever." Kay bit his lips in impatience. "Sir," said Barnabas, bending his head gently. Kay almost let this seduce him again into believing Barnabas. "I'll certainly deliver it. And the other message you gave me recently, I'll certainly deliver that too." "What?" cried Kay. "You mean you haven't delivered it yet? Didn't you go to the castle the following day?" "No," said Barnabas. "My dear father is old, well, you saw him, and just then there was a great deal of work. I had to help him, but I'll soon be going up to the castle again." "But what are you doing, you incomprehensible person, you?" cried Kay, slapping himself on the forehead. "Don't Clam's affairs take precedence over everything else? You have the high position of messenger, yet you discharge it so shamefully? Who cares about your father's work? Clam is waiting for news, but instead of rushing there head over heels, you spend your time carting dung from the cowshed." "My father is a shoemaker," Barnabas said, undeterred. "He had orders from Brunswick, and I am father's apprentice." "Shoemaker, orders, Brunswick," Kay cried bitterly, as if trying to make each word forever unusable. "And who needs shoes here on these everlastingly empty paths? And why should I care about shoemaking? I entrusted a message to you not so you would forget it or garble it on your cobbler's bench, but so you would take it to the gentleman right away." Kay now calmed down somewhat on realizing that all this time Clam had probably not been at the castle, but rather at the gentleman's inn. Yet Barnabas annoyed him again, for in an effort to prove that he had memorized Kay's first message, he began reciting it. "That's enough. I don't want to hear it," said Kay. "Don't be angry at me, sir," said Barnabas. And then, as if unconsciously wanting to punish Kay, he withdrew his gaze and lowered his eyes, but probably only in dismay over Kay's raised voice. "I'm not angry at you," said Kay, and now he himself was overcome by uneasiness. "No, not at you, though it's very bad for me to have only a messenger like this for important business." "Look," said Barnabas, and it seemed as if, in an attempt to defend his honour as a messenger, he was saying more than he ought. "Clam doesn't wait for the news. He even gets annoyed when I come. 'More fresh news,' he once said, and he usually stands up on seeing me come from afar, goes into the next room and doesn't receive me. Besides, it hasn't been stipulated that I should take every message there at once. Had it been stipulated, I would naturally go at once, but it wasn't stipulated, and if I never went, nobody would admonish me because of that. Whenever I take a message, I do so voluntarily." "Fine," said Kay, observing Barnabas and studiously looking away from the assistants, who took turns slowly rising up from behind Barnabas's shoulders as if through a trapdoor, and then quickly, whistling a little in imitation of the wind as if frightened by the sight of Kay, they disappeared again, amusing themselves at length in this way. How it is at Clam's, I don't know, but I doubt that you can distinguish everything clearly there, and even if you could, we couldn't bring about any improvement. But you can take a message, and that's what I ask of you, an extremely short message. Can you deliver it tomorrow, right away, and give me the answer tomorrow, right away, or at least let me know how you were received? Can you, and will you? That would be very valuable for me. And perhaps I will still get an opportunity to thank you fittingly, or perhaps you already have a wish that I can grant you. Well, certainly I shall carry out the assignment, said Barnabas. And will you endeavour to carry it out as well as possible, and to deliver it to Clam himself, to get the answer from Clam himself very soon, and to do all this immediately, tomorrow, tomorrow morning, will you? I'll do my best, said Barnabas, but then I always do. Let's stop fighting about this, said Kay. Here is the assignment. The surveyor K asks the director for permission to call on him in person and accepts in advance all stipulations that might be attached to any such permission. He is obliged to make this request because all previous intermediaries have utterly failed, as proof of which he adduces the fact that he has done no surveying so far and, judging by the council chairman's statement, will never do so. It was therefore with a desperate feeling of shame that he read the director's last letter, and the only thing that can help here is a personal interview with the director. The surveyor realizes the burdensome nature of this request, but he will try to minimize any disruption to the director. He submits to all restrictions as regards time, including, for example, a restriction on the number of words he may use during the interview. He believes that he could even make do with 10 words. With deep reverence and extreme impatience, he awaits the decision. Kay had spoken in utter self-forgetfulness, as though he stood at Clam's door and spoke with the doorkeeper. "It's become much longer than I expected," he then said. "But you must nonetheless deliver it orally. I don't want to write a letter, for it would once again travel along the endless path of the files." It was only for Barnabas's sake that Kay scribbled down the message on a piece of paper on one assistant's back while the other shone the light. But Kay was all ready to take it down right away from the dictation of Barnabas, who had retained everything and recited it with a schoolchild's precision, disregarding the false clues given by the assistants. "You have an extraordinary memory," said Kay, handing him the paper. "And now please show that you're extraordinary in other ways, too. And what about your wishes? Have you none? Indeed, to be frank, I would be somewhat reassured about the fate of my message if you had some." At first, Barnabas kept silent, and then he said, "My sisters send you their regards." "Your sisters?" said Kay. "Yes, those big, strong girls." "Both send their regards, but especially Amalia," said Barnabas. "Today she gave me this letter for you from the castle." Latching on to that particular communication, Kay asked, "Couldn't she also take my message to the castle? Or couldn't both of you go and each of you try your luck?" "Amalia isn't allowed into the offices," said Barnabas. "Otherwise she would certainly be glad to do so." "I shall perhaps come to see you tomorrow," said Kay. "But do come here first with the answer. I shall wait for you at the school. My regards to your sisters, too." Kay's promise seemed to have made Barnabas quite happy. He not only gave Kay a parting handshake, but touched him lightly on the shoulder. As though everything were once more as it had been when Barnabas in his radiance first came among the peasants in the taproom, Kay, though smiling, regarded Barnabas's gesture as a distinction. Having mellowed, on the way back he let the assistants do as they pleased. Chapter 11. In the Schoolhouse. He arrived home completely frozen. It was dark everywhere. The candles in the lanterns had burned down, and, led by the assistants, who already knew their way around, he groped his way through a schoolroom. "Your first praiseworthy deed," he said, recalling Clam's letter. From a corner, Frida, still half asleep, cried, "Let Kay sleep. Don't disturb him." So preoccupied was she with thoughts of Kay, even though, overcome by sleepiness, she hadn't been able to wait up for him. Then the lamp was lit, but it couldn't be turned up all that high since there wasn't much kerosene left. This new household still had a number of deficiencies. True, the stove was lit, but the large room, which was also used for gymnastics, the equipment lay on the floor and hung from the ceiling, had used up the entire supply of wood, and though it had been pleasantly warm, so Kay was assured, in the meantime it had, alas, cooled down again. Though there was a large supply of wood in a shed, the shed was locked and the key with the teacher, who permitted wood to be removed only for heating during school hours. This would have been tolerable had there been beds to take refuge in, but there was nothing of the sort. except for a straw mattress covered with commendable cleanliness by a woolen shawl of Frida's, but there was no eiderdown and only two stiff, coarse blankets, which barely gave off any warmth. And now the assistants greedily eyed this miserable straw mattress, though naturally without hope of ever lying on it. Anxiously, Frida looked at Kay. She had shown at the Bridge Inn that she could take any room, no matter how miserable, and make it comfortable to live in. But she couldn't have done anything more here, completely without means as she was. "Our only decoration is the gymnastic equipment," she said, smiling with difficulty under her tears. But as for the main deficiencies, the inadequate sleeping arrangements and the heating, she would definitely see to them tomorrow, and was only asking Kay to be patient till then. There was not a word, a hint, a sign to suggest that she bore Kay the slightest bitterness in her heart, though he had torn her not only from the Gentleman's Inn, but now, as he had to admit to himself, from the Bridge Inn, too. But that is why he was making an effort to find all of this bearable, which was not all that difficult, for in thought he was walking alongside Barnabas, repeating the message word for word, not as he had told it to Barnabas, but as he thought it would sound in front of Clam. Still, he was genuinely looking forward to the coffee Frida had made for him on a kerosene burner, and, leaning on the now almost cold stove, he followed the quick and experienced movements with which she spread the inevitable white cloth on the teacher's desk, put out a flowered coffee cup along with some bread and bacon, and even a tin of sardines. Everything was ready. Frida hadn't eaten either, but had waited for Kay. There were two chairs at hand. Kay and Frida sat down at the table, the assistants at their feet on the podium, but they wouldn't stay quiet, and even created a disturbance during the meal. Though they had plenty of everything and were still nowhere near finished, now and then they got up to ascertain how much food was still left on the table and whether they could expect any more. Kay was not in the least concerned about the assistants and took notice of them only when Frida laughed. Then he covered her hand cajolingly with his and asked softly why she treated them so leniently and tolerated their misconduct. That was certainly no way to get rid of them, but if you dealt with them very firmly, as became their conduct, you could rein them in, or, and this was not only more likely but also better still, make their position so unpleasant that they would finally run away. It looked as if their stay in the school wouldn't be particularly pleasant, and of course it wouldn't last, but they would barely notice all the deficiencies if the assistants left and the two of them were alone in the silent building. Didn't she notice, too, that the assistants were getting cheekier each day, as though they were encouraged by Frida's presence and the hope that, with Frida there, Kay wouldn't deal as vigorously with them as he would otherwise have done? Incidentally, there might be some extremely simple measures for getting rid of them at once, without fuss, and perhaps Frida even knew of some, given her intimate knowledge of local affairs. And one would probably only be doing the assistants a favour by driving them away, for the life they led here could scarcely be called luxurious, and they would have to cease lounging about, or at least do less of that, since they would have to work, whereas Frida needed to go easy on herself after the excitement of the last few days, and he, Kay, would be busy seeking a way out of their predicament. Still, if the assistants left, he would feel so relieved that he could easily take care of all the janitorial work in addition to everything else. Frida, who had listened carefully, stroked his arm slowly and said she fully agreed with him, though he had perhaps exaggerated the assistants' misconduct. They were young lads, cheerful and somewhat simple-minded, serving a stranger for the first time, newly freed from the severity of castle discipline, and therefore always a little excited and bewildered, and in that state apt to get up to silly mischief, and though it was quite natural to get annoyed at this, the more sensible approach would be to laugh. There were times when she herself simply couldn't keep from laughing. Still, she fully agreed with Kay that it would be best to send them away and be all on their own here together. She drew closer to Kay and hid her face on his shoulder, and in that position, speaking so incomprehensibly that Kay had to bend down to her, she said that she knew of no measure that could be taken against the assistants and feared that everything Kay had suggested would be futile. To the best of her knowledge, it was Kay who requested them, and now he had them and must keep them. It would be best to accept them light-heartedly, as the light-hearted sort they were. That was the easiest way to put up with them. Kay was dissatisfied with this answer. Half in jest and half seriously, he said that she seemed to be in league with them, or was at least fond of them. Well, they were handsome lads, all right, but there was nobody who couldn't somehow be got rid of, given a bit of goodwill, and he would demonstrate this to her with the assistants. Frida said she would be most grateful to him if he succeeded. Besides, from now on she wouldn't laugh at them or speak to them, except when necessary. She no longer considered them funny. It wasn't a trifling matter being constantly observed by two men. She had learned to see them through his eyes. And she really did recoil a little when the assistants got up again, partly to check the provisions, partly to investigate the constant whispering. Kay took advantage of this to turn Frida against the assistants. He drew Frida toward him, and, seated close together, they finished the meal. It was certainly time for bed, and indeed everyone was tired. One of the assistants had even fallen asleep over his meal, much to the amusement of the other, who tried to persuade his masters to come and look at the silly face of the sleeping assistant, but to no avail. On the chairs above, Kay and Frida remained seated, dismissively. The cold having become increasingly unbearable, they were hesitant to go to bed. So in the end, Kay declared that they had to light the stove, otherwise they wouldn't get any sleep. He looked around for an axe. The assistants knew of one and brought it over. They set off for the woodshed. In no time, the light door was broken down. Delighted, as if they had never before experienced anything so wonderful, chasing and pushing each other, they began to carry wood into the schoolroom, where there was soon a large pile. They lit the stove, and everybody installed themselves around it. The assistants were given a blanket to wrap themselves in. That was adequate for them, since it had been agreed they would take turns staying awake to keep the stove going. Soon it was so warm by the stove that the blankets were no longer required. The lamp was extinguished, and, pleased with the warmth and quiet, Kay and Frida stretched out to sleep. Awakened at night by some noise, Kay first groped about drowsily for Frida before noticing that it was not Frida who lay beside him, but one of the assistants. No doubt because of his irritation on being suddenly awakened, this came as the greatest shock he had experienced in the village up to now. With a shout he half rose and, without stopping to think, struck the assistant so hard with his fist that he began to cry. But the matter was soon resolved. Frida had also been awakened. At least, this is how it seemed to her, when some large animal, possibly a cat, had jumped onto her chest and then immediately run off. She had risen and gone through the room, candle in hand, looking for the animal. The assistant had seized the chance to sample the pleasure afforded by the straw mattress, for which he was now paying a bitter price. Unable to find anything, perhaps it had all been an illusion, Frida returned to Kay. But on the way, as though she had forgotten all about the conversation earlier that afternoon, she stroked the hair of the crouching, whimpering assistant in order to console him. Kay didn't say a word about this. He simply ordered the assistants to stop stoking the fire, since, with the expenditure of almost the entire pile of wood, the room was already much too hot. Next morning, none of them woke up until after the first schoolchildren had come and gathered eagerly around their bed. This was unpleasant, for, owing to the intense heat, which had in any case yielded to bitter cold toward morning, they had all stripped to their undershirts, and just as they were beginning to get dressed, Gisa, the schoolmistress, a tall, blonde, beautiful, if rather stiff, girl, appeared in the doorway. She was clearly prepared to deal with the new janitor, having perhaps been briefed by the teacher, for, while still on the threshold, she said, "I simply cannot tolerate this. What a fine state of affairs that would be! You merely have permission to sleep in the schoolroom. I'm not obliged to teach in your bedroom. A janitor's family lounging about in bed till late morning. Ugh!" Well, you could object to some of that, especially about the family and the beds, thought Kay, as he and Frida, the assistants could not be used for this, lying on the floor they were staring in wonder at the schoolmistress and the children, in great haste dragged over the parallel bars and the horse, threw the blankets on them, creating a little room where one could at least dress, shielded from the children's stares. Still, there wasn't a moment's peace. The schoolmistress was already scolding him because there was no fresh water in the washbasin. Kay had just been thinking of bringing over the washbasin for Frida and himself, but he abandoned the thought for now, so as not to needlessly annoy the schoolmistress. But the sacrifice was futile, for just then there was a loud crash. Unfortunately, they had forgotten to clear the remnants of the evening meal from the teacher's desk. The schoolmistress removed all of it with the ruler. Everything was sent flying to the floor. And anyhow, the schoolmistress didn't have to worry about the spilled sardine oil and coffee dregs and the smashed coffee pot. The janitor would, of course, tidy up right away. Not yet fully clothed, Kay and Frida leaned upon the parallel bars, watching the destruction of their few belongings. The assistants, who clearly hadn't the slightest intention of getting dressed, peeped out through the blankets below, much to the children's delight. Frida was, of course, most upset by the loss of the coffee pot. Only when Kay, in an effort to console her, assured her that he would go to the council chairman at once to demand, and what's more, obtain compensation, did she compose herself sufficiently to run out of the enclosure, dressed only in a chemise and slip, so as to fetch the tablecloth and prevent its getting dirtier. She succeeded, even though the schoolmistress, in an effort to frighten her off, kept slamming the ruler down nerve-wrackingly on the table. After Kay and Frida put on their clothes, they found it necessary to prod the assistants, who seemed dazed by all this, to get dressed, ordering them, pushing them, and to some extent even dressing them themselves. Then, when everybody was ready, Kay assigned the next tasks. The assistants should get wood and light the stove, but first in the other schoolroom, where great danger lurked, for the teacher was probably already there. Frida was to wash the floor while Kay went for water and did a general tidying up. There could be no thought of breakfast for now. Kay wanted to be first outside, so as to ascertain the teacher's mood. The others should follow when he called. He gave this order, on the one hand, because he wanted to ensure that the stupid antics of the assistants didn't make matters worse from the start, and, on the other, because he wanted to spare Frida as much as possible, for she had ambition. He had none. She was sensitive. He was not. Her thoughts centred exclusively on the minor abominations of the present, his on Barnabas and the future. Frida listened carefully to his instructions and barely took her eyes off him. No sooner had he stepped outside than the schoolmistress cried amid the children's laughter, which from then on simply would not end, "Well, are you quite rested now?" And when, instead of answering, for this was hardly a question, Kay headed toward the washstand, the schoolmistress asked, "But what have you done to my kitty?" A large, heavy old cat lay sprawled lazily on the table. The schoolmistress was examining one of its paws, which was evidently slightly injured. So Frida was right. This cat certainly hadn't jumped on her, for she was surely no longer capable of jumping, though she had indeed crawled over her, and then, shocked to find people in the usually empty building, quickly hidden, injuring herself in her unaccustomed haste. Kay tried to explain this calmly to the schoolmistress, but, ignoring everything except the result, she said, "Yes, you certainly have injured her. What a marvellous way of introducing yourselves here. Look." And calling Kay to the teacher's desk, she showed him the paw, and, before he knew what was happening, scratched the back of his hand with the claws. Though the claws were already blunt, the schoolmistress, who no longer showed the slightest concern for the cat, pressed down so firmly that they nonetheless left bloody welts. "And now get back to work," she said impatiently, bending over the cat again. Frida, who had been watching from behind the parallel bars with the assistants, screamed at the sight of the blood. Kay showed his hand to the children and said, "Look what an evil, cunning cat has done." He wasn't saying this for the children. Their screaming and laughter had already taken on such a life of its own that it needed no further motive or provocation and couldn't be pierced or influenced in any way by words. But since the schoolmistress merely responded to the insult with a sidelong glance and for the rest remained intent on her cat, her initial fury evidently sated by the bloody punishment, Kay called Frida and the assistants, and they set to work. After Kay had taken out the bucket with the dirty water, brought in fresh water, and begun to sweep the schoolroom, a boy of about 12 stepped out from a bench, touched Kay's hand, and said something that was incomprehensible in the noise. Suddenly the noise ceased. Kay turned around. His greatest fear all morning had come about. Standing in the doorway was the teacher. In each hand the little man held an assistant by the collar. He had probably caught them while they were getting wood, for in a powerful voice he shouted, pausing after each word, "Who dared to break into the woodshed? Tell me where the fellow is so I can tear him to bits." Then Frida got up from the floor, which she had been laboriously washing at the feet of the schoolmistress, looked at Kay, as if trying to summon strength, and then, with some of her former superiority in gaze and bearing, said, "I did it, teacher. I could think of no other solution. The stoves in the schoolroom had to be lit by morning, so someone had to open the shed. I didn't dare to go get the key from your house at night. My fiancé was at the gentleman's inn and might conceivably have spent the night there, so I had to make the decision on my own. If what I did was wrong, excuse my inexperience. My fiancé gave me quite a scolding when he saw what had happened. He even forbade me to light the stoves earlier, for he thought you had indicated by locking the shed that you didn't want the stoves lit before you came. So it's his fault the stoves weren't lit, and mine the shed was broken into." "Who broke open the door?" the teacher asked the assistants, who were still vainly attempting to shake off his grip. "The gentleman," both said at once, and to exclude all doubt, they pointed at Kay. Laughing in a manner that seemed even more conclusive than her words, Frida began to wring into the bucket the rag she had used to wash the floor, as if her explanation had terminated the matter, and the assistant's explanation were only a belated joke. She was already on her knees and about to begin work when she said, "Our assistants are still children, who, despite their years, still belong on these school benches. for it was I who opened the door with the axe myself. It was very easy. I didn't need the assistance. They would merely have been in the way. But then at night, when my fiancé got back and went out to inspect and possibly repair the damage, the assistants ran after him, probably because they were afraid of being left here alone. They saw my fiancé working on the torn-off door, which is why they now say, well, they are children. Yet the assistants shook their heads repeatedly during Frida's explanation, pointed again at Kay, and attempted through silent mimicry to get Frida to change her mind. It was to no avail, though, and so they finally gave up, accepted Frida's words as an order, and on being asked again by the teacher, refused to answer.
Oh, said the teacher, so you lied, or at least accused the janitor on frivolous grounds.
They remained silent, but their trembling, frightened glances appeared to suggest guilt.
Then I will give you a good beating this instant, the teacher said, and sent a child to the other room for the cane.
Then, as he raised the cane, Frida cried, "The assistants were telling the truth," and in desperation she threw the rag into the bucket with such force that the water splashed out and ran behind the parallel bars where she hid herself.
"A pack of liars," said the schoolmistress, who had finished bandaging the paw and took the creature onto her lap, for which it was almost too wide.
"So that leaves the janitor here," said the teacher, pushing the assistants aside and turning to Kay, who had listened all along, resting on his broom. "This janitor, who, out of sheer cowardice, openly admits that others are being wrongly accused of his dirty tricks."
"Now," said Kay, realizing that Frida's intervention had softened the teacher's initially unrestrained outburst of anger, "I wouldn't have been sorry if the assistants had received a little beating. They were let off scot-free on 10 just occasions, and can certainly atone for it on a single unjust one. But, teacher, in other ways, too, I would have preferred to avoid an outright confrontation between us, and you might have preferred that, too. However, since Frida has sacrificed me to the assistants," here Kay paused, Frida's sobs came from behind the blanket, "we must naturally straighten all this out."
"Outrageous," said the schoolmistress.
"I agree with you entirely, Miss Geeser," said the teacher. "You, janitor, are of course dismissed on the spot, owing to this disgraceful dereliction of duty. I reserve the right to impose further punishment, but get out of this building now with all your things. For us, this is truly a great relief. Classes can finally begin. Quick now."
"I'm not moving," said Kay.
"You certainly are my superior, but not the person who granted me this position. That was the council chairman, and he's the only one from whom I shall accept notification of dismissal."
This book is continued on Disc 5.